Welcome to the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel. This week, playing catch-up in Kabul. 21-year-old Rona couldn't go to school under the Taliban. Now she's in the third grade.
It's a little depressing, all this lost time. When I see all these little kids, I remember my own childhood, and I wonder what might have been.
Shining shoes on the streets of Hong Kong.
There's a lot of pressure in polishing shoes. You know why? Because you have to get the front and the back. You can't cut corners. You have to make the shoes sparkle. If not, who needs you?
And music from Madagascar. Razia Saeed tells us about her latest album. Around the World with the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel, in this week for Peggy Wehmeyer. The port city of Jacmel in Haiti was hit hard by the January earthquake. Known for a long time as a center for arts and crafts, Jacmel has the only film school in the country. As soon as the earthquake struck, students from the Ciné Institute took their cameras into the streets to document what was happening. Their footage was picked up by international networks and seen on TV screens around the world. It's a far cry from the fiction films they'd been working on before the disaster. Grant Fuller visited the school and he sent us this report.
Up until the earthquake, students at the Ciné Institute cranked out films like this one, a short comedy about a bunch of characters chasing after an elusive $10 bill on the street. At Haiti's only film school, the focus was on fiction.
And then when the quake hit, they pretty much automatically became a newsroom, like overnight.
American filmmaker Annie Nascenti is part of the Institute's rotating faculty. She watched as January 12th transformed her students' work into something very different. In this video, shot by students in the first days after the earthquake, hundreds of Haitians shout at guards in front of a World Food Program office. They're protesting food shortages in Jacmel. The students worked quickly to post images like these on the school's website. And before they knew it, the clips had aired on CNN, PBS, and the BBC. In the days that followed, foreign aid started trickling into their town. Nascenti thinks the arrival of relief to Jacmel was a direct result of Ciné Institute's news footage. For the young students, it was a feeling they'll never forget.
If they ever wondered why make movies, they know now. They really know now, because they saw their movies help people.
The students of Ciné Institute are also victims. Their classroom building collapsed, and their production studio is a cracked, crumbling danger zone. A local charity has provided a small room for the school, and several film students who lost their homes now sleep on the classroom floor. First-year student Vadim Jean says making movies is good medicine, even if they're about the earthquake's aftermath.
Seriously? Ciné Institute is like therapy. If it wasn't for the school, I would probably be like the other people around me who are stressed. People have lost their minds. But because I'm so caught up in my work and I love the work that I do, it's therapy.
Jean is part of a team of students organizing a regular Movie Under the Stars event where they screen their work in nearby tent cities. Some students feel lucky to be alive and working at all. Rosalie Charles was on her way to Port-au-Prince when the quake struck. She was the last one to get in touch with the school, and her fellow students feared the worst.
They actually even put my picture up on Facebook as one of the people who died because they couldn't find me. And it's not until communication was back up that I called them and told them I was okay.
She says the good news was like a shot of energy for this tight-knit group of 46 students.
It was so amazing because everybody was so happy. And after that moment, I said I couldn't stay where I was. I had to get back. So I went back to the school and I started working again.
Today, a student crew is filming at an HIV support center in Jacmel. As a volunteer prepares to hand out personal hygiene kits, Leslie Desan moves around him with a handheld camera.
We just want to show that these people were in a situation before that was deplorable. Now it's become worse, or maybe it's actually become a little bit better, depending on how you look at it, because they're getting more help now than they were before.
Pierre Bergard is another member of the crew. What I'm doing right now is my passion, he says, so I can't say that I'm tired. And besides, I think this is my way of helping out. Just about everything the Siné Institute produces right now is related to the earthquake. Even so, instructor Annie Nascenti says it's not all about doom and destruction.
Because a lot of the footage you see coming out of Haiti is problems, 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 but there's tons of joy and tons of fun and tons of great things happening, and the Haitians don't necessarily want to make movies about their misery.
So the students have made documentaries about things like musicians playing in displacement camps, and about artisans who continued to make traditional festive masks despite the cancellation of Carnival last month. All the hard work has catapulted the school from small-town Haiti to international recognition. In the recent We Are the World video remake, all the images of Haiti were shot by Siné Institute students. And Nascenti says the opportunities keep on coming.
We started getting calls, assignments. Now we have a series on CBC TV in Canada where every week they're going to premiere four of the films. And they especially want films of transcendence and hope.
One day, when things calm down in Haiti, the students plan to make lighthearted fiction films once again. But no one knows exactly when that might happen. For the World Vision Report, I'm Grant Fuller in Jacmel, Haiti.
You can see some of the students' films on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Vin danser maman moi, ga danser maman moi, ga bodja maman moi, m'pap ka payo sa mwen dwe yo. Vin danser maman moi, fwa souri maman.
In the 30 years that Afghanistan was at war with the Soviets and then the Taliban, many young people went without a basic education, especially girls. These girls are now young women, and they're mostly too old to go back to elementary school. But there is a school in the Afghan capital that's giving them a chance to get the education they missed. Reporter Will Everett visited the school, where he met a 21-year-old named Rona.
It's recess, and a dozen third-grade girls skip rope in a school courtyard. As the song from Sesame Street goes, one of these is not like the other. Standing out among the laughing 9-year-olds is a tall, very serious woman in a headscarf holding the end of a rope. That's 21-year-old Rona. She's not the teacher, but a fellow third grader. A teacher comes out and taps a bell with a rock, signaling the end of recess. The girls run to class, followed at a slight distance by Rona, who keeps to herself. It's the hour for religious studies, and the teacher writes an Islamic verse on the dry erase board. The subject is prayer. As the students respond to questions, Rona remains silent, staring at the Quran open on the desk before her and mouthing the words. Rona never went to school as a kid. When she was 7, her father died. Plunged into poverty, the family left Kabul for the provinces.
After my father died, my mother and brothers moved to Kapisa province. There was no school in our village, and it would have cost money to send me to school somewhere else.
This was during the reign of the Taliban, when girls weren't even allowed to leave the house alone, much less attend school. Rona would have had to leave the country to get an education. While her two brothers got educations and later jobs, Rona and her sister stayed home and took in sewing to get by.
Last year we moved back to Kabul. I asked my brother if I could go to school. He's been to college, and he knows the importance of being able to read and write. So he said I could go.
Problem was, she was too old. The Afghan Ministry of Education has ruled that students who've never gone to school can't enroll after age 10. But then she heard about a school run by an organization called Afghans for Tomorrow, where people can go back to school regardless of their age. Kim McCall is the president of Afghans for Tomorrow.
Many girls missed years of school. So when we opened up our schools, we found that there was a huge demand for education for girls that might be 11, 12, 17, who really are only, maybe first grade level.
The school's principal, Layla Saidi, says the government's rule keeping younger and older students apart is understandable.
The government doesn't want to mix the younger students with the older ones. They say the older students have a different mentality, different life experiences, and perhaps that's true. But as you can see, the students here get along just fine. The older students bring their maturity to the classroom.
Once again, a teacher sounds the bell, signaling the change of subjects. Classes here are accelerated so that the girls move ahead 2 grades per year. Next is math class. Rona shares a desk with a girl half her size. When the teacher calls on her to solve a basic problem in addition, Rona stumbles. The girls are politely quiet while she searches for an answer, but Rona is embarrassed. Math isn't her strong suit. She squeezes her fists until her knuckles are white. Her hands are covered with tattoos. It's a permanent reminder of Taliban times, when girls, hiding in the house with nothing to do, would tattoo designs on each other using ink and a nail. Rona has an 18-year-old sister who remembers little of those times. She too is uneducated, but Rona says she doesn't share her thirst for knowledge.
After my first day here at school, I was excited and told my younger sister about it. The next day she came with me, but she only stayed in school for a week. She said she preferred to stay home and get married.
Rona knows she has a long way to go. At the rate she's going, she'll be about 25 by the time she graduates from high school.
It's a little depressing, all this lost time. When I see all these little kids, I remember my own childhood, and I wonder what might have been.
Her dream now, to become a school teacher.
I haven't told my brother about my career goals. I'm afraid of what he'll say. Maybe he'll let me. Maybe not.
That's because their mother is in her late 50s, which is pretty old by Afghan standards. And if Rona doesn't marry, she'll be expected to stay home and take care of her. So her future depends not on what she wants, but on what her brother decides to let her do. For the World Vision Report, this is Will Everett, Kabul, Afghanistan.
Rona and her friends might be listening to this on the radio. Afghan hip-hop is very popular with young people in the capital. The songs are in Dara, Pashto, or in English. This song is called Sitara. It's by Behzhan Zafarmel, a resident of Kabul and a popular hip-hop artist.
Come on, everybody! Sitara. Chimega. Ha! Tumara migi ki tumara dostori. Aroz barem TV kulo esam misrawan mikuni. Tumara migi ki tumara khushori. Dekho padar o madar ma khudi razi.
Angelina Jolie and Brad Pitt are not just famous for their movies or their marriage, they're also famous for their philanthropy. They're part of a new revolution in giving. That story's just ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel in for Peggy Wehmeyer. They've learned how to make corn cobs into charcoal, and they figured out how to spot waterborne bacteria using a baby's bottle. Armed with that kind of know-how, students from the popular D-Lab development class at MIT have been to Africa, Asia, and Latin America, and they've put their ideas into practice. Chris Burrell attended some D-Lab classes, and he brings us this story from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Four students lean over a table and blow on a clear plexiglass device, about the size of a jumbo candy bar. The open-sided box is actually a wind generator. Students blow on a strip of Teflon tightened across two bolts inside the gizmo, like kids trying to put out birthday candles. The goal is to make the strip flutter enough to generate electricity. Well, at least that's the goal.
1, 2, 3. Okay, 1, 2, 3.
Nothing.
Failure, guys.
I think this needs to be tightened.
Welcome to MIT's D-Lab, where undergrads learn how to build low-cost and sustainable technology for use in developing countries. Everything from pedal-powered washing machines to portable solar cook stoves. The D stands for Development, Design, and dissemination.
Like, this is the class I would have loved to have taken when I was an undergraduate.
That's instructor Amy Smith, D-Lab's creator. She won a MacArthur Genius Grant in 2004, and Wired magazine dubbed her the MacGyver for the Third World. Smith studied mechanical engineering at MIT and spent 4 years in the Peace Corps in Botswana. That experience fueled her passion to use simple technologies to improve the lives of the world's poorest people.
So, I don't know if you all knew that I was in Uganda for a couple of weeks, which is why I wasn't here, and which is why I'm kind of tan now.
Smith is just back from a mid-semester trip and telling her students about it. She was in Uganda to build labor-saving devices, including handheld corn shellers. After Smith showed people how to make them out of salvaged metal, villagers ran with it.
And then the next day, it was so cool because we came back, and there were just like stacks of corn shellers and piles of corn shellers everywhere. They were all really wonderfully done corn shellers, and so that was pretty exciting to see.
Students light Bunsen burners and sterilize tools as they prepare to build one of the Smith's inventions, a water quality testing device that costs less than 2 movie tickets. How's that compared to store-bought?
You know, it costs like between $850 and $1,000. Oh. Seriously? So what did we do in D-Lab? We made a cheap solution. What we use is we use baby bottles. Baby bottles come with sterile inserts.
The sterilized bottle is fitted with a thin piece of paper designed to trap bacteria. After a water sample is poured in, the filter is placed in a petri dish and cultured.
So that's the one that if it turns black, you know that it's contaminated, right?
Yes.
This device is being used by rural health centers in Ecuador and Zambia. Clean-burning charcoal is another innovation that's vaulted out of D-Lab into the real world. It's made from corn cobs and other agricultural waste. More than 60 workshops in Haiti manufacture the cooking fuel that's helping put a dent in the rate of deforestation there. A student grinds the edges off rebar to make a smooth crank for a charcoal crusher. As sophomore Shami Kudus from Bangladesh ponders, what's at stake for someone in the developing world who adopts a new technology?
The risk associated with the lives of poor people is unimaginable. For them to accept a new technology, for them to switch to something new, there's great risk involved because if it doesn't work, you know, it's their lives and their livelihoods.
This is the kind of reflection that Smith encourages in her students before they head overseas. Each semester, students work in a developing country for a month. They're grouped into country teams of 5 or 6 and partner with local organizations, such as the Peace Corps, to work on projects tailored to the needs of those communities. But learning how to build a peanut sheller? That requires a little demolition first. In an alley on the edge of campus, a few students gather around a blue tarp. Junior Nora Nakubuka swings a sledgehammer against what looks like a concrete mixing bowl, sending jagged chunks flying. It's actually the D-Lab's only prototype of a peanut sheller, a labor-saving device that costs about $50 in materials. It's capable of shelling 110 pounds of nuts in an hour, a task that would take 30 hours by hand. To learn how to build one, students have to smash this model and salvage the bolts and cranks sticking out of it. Nakubuka, an electrical engineering major, dressed in a pink sweater and safety goggles, thwacks away.
I was really interested in getting a different experience from my other MIT classes.
Nakubuka was born and raised in central Uganda and says conventional aid breeds dependency.
I think that like the D-Lab philosophy is so different. Going to the community and building the technologies with the community instead of handing down stuff to them.
Her team will soon travel to a village in Rwanda where the only source of electricity is a single diesel generator. They're already testing out a theory that the school playground could harbor a mini power plant.
We are looking at generation of energy using a small merry-go-round and also a seesaw when you have like about like 500 kids on those for like a week. Then each time they play outside, we could get a way of capturing that energy and we could store it in a battery.
Sounds like another D-Lab innovation in the making. For the World Vision Report, I'm Chris Burrell in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
You can see photos of the D-Lab on our website, worldvisionreport.org. Journalist and author Matthew Bishop believes that giving can change the world. And, he says, there's a new generation of entrepreneurs and celebrities who are willing to take on the challenge. In fact, you've probably heard about some of them. Bill Gates, Bill Clinton, Bono. They're all part of a revolutionary movement Bishop and his co-author Michael Green call philanthrocapitalism. That's where the super rich give away billions of dollars and use their skills and their fame to try and solve some of the world's most pressing problems. The World Vision Report's Peggy Wehmeyer asked Matthew Bishop whether the recession was having an effect on this new movement.
To me, the recession has reinforced the message because, for a start, I think it's much clearer that the people who've done well really do have a responsibility to society to give back. We see some of the people on Wall Street who've been very selfish out of this last few months with all the money that the taxpayers bailed them out with. What we're looking for is a different sort of leadership from the successful people in our society, and people like Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, I think, are showing an alternative model. Secondly, I think the people who've weathered the storm best are the wealthy, and therefore they are better placed to give than the rest of us, and so they need to start doing it. And thirdly, government, I think, is under more pressure than ever. There's much less money from the taxpayer to go around to solve some of these big problems. And so actually there's a greater need than ever before for the private sector, for the privately wealthy, and indeed the rest of us to dig deep into our pockets and actually give.
How does philanthrocapitalism fit in with the role of government? Many people say, well, it's government's job to, for example, help a failing school system. I know that in New York, philanthropists are actually playing a significant role in the school system. What's going on there?
I think we'd all love government to have the answers and to be able to solve these difficult problems. But the reality is that we've learned over the last 30 or 40 years that government doesn't have the answers. And in fact, in some ways, is quite a poor solver of social problems. Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, I talked to him at length for the book, and he says he expected as a businessman when he became mayor of New York that he'd be able to innovate in government, and he found that innovation was actually impossible. The politics of taking risks, which is, after all, what innovation is all about, are so difficult that politicians, because they have to get re-elected, they just feel very, very cautious. And so what he's ended up doing is, whenever there's a nice idea that he wants to test out, something in charter schools or something with paying poor parents to get their children vaccinated, he gets philanthropists to fund pilot schemes. If those pilot schemes work, he can then go to the city council and say, this isn't a high-risk change, this is a proven solution.
So it sounds to me like you're intimating here that while government and nonprofit groups have great risk in trying to start new programs to help the poor because they've got voters, they've got bureaucracy, they've got people who are constantly holding them accountable. For the very wealthy, all they have to lose is their money.
Exactly what I'm saying. Yeah, there's one thing that the wealthy have is enough money to take a few risks and lose some of that money. It's their money, so no one's going to say to them, you're wasting that money.
Or voting them out of office.
Or voting them out of office or whatever. I mean, that they are free to use that money how they like. And to me, it's fantastic if they put that money to work taking risks on trying things that make a better society.
It seems much more complicated now that if people like Bill Gates, who are used to hiring and firing people and getting things fixed and done quickly in the business world, now have to work with bureaucracies and nonprofit organizations. How are they adjusting to that very different model of operating a system?
Well, that's right. Warren Buffett, when he decided to give away his vast fortune, he said, giving money away is much harder than making it. In business, what you do is you're looking for the low-hanging fruit, the easy ways to make money. In philanthropy and giving, you're looking to solve the really hard problems that generations of some of the most talented people in the world have failed to solve. And I think one of the first things that you see is that when people move from the world of business into the world of solving social problems, they have all sorts of culture shock. They're used to being in charge. They're used to saying something and it happens. And suddenly they've got to persuade people, they've got to deal with bureaucracies, they've got to deal with governments, they've got public protests sometimes. And so there's a whole load of new things to familiarize yourself with, which are quite a shock. what Warren Buffett did was to give all his money to Bill Gates to give away. And the reason he said that was, he just didn't really enjoy dealing with all those people in the nonprofit sector. He much preferred dealing with people who were focused on making money or playing bridge. And that's how he liked to spend his time. So it's quite smart to give it to Gates, who I think is much more interested in the nitty gritty of solving problems.
Having interviewed these people, what do you find most of their motivations are for wanting to take risks with their money and give so much away?
Well, yeah, the reality is we don't know deep down what's motivating anybody. And some of them, I'm sure it is about ego. It's about they love the black tie dinners in their honor. Other people, they made their money doing things that were perhaps a little bit suspect or fringe, and they want to clean up their image. But I think, by and large, you look at someone like Bill Gates, what he's found is that he is able to help solve a big problem. And he's excited by that. I was very struck by how, when we spoke, the more he talked about what he could do, he started rocking backwards and forwards in his seat, and he was tapping his pencil in a kind of rhythmic way because he was sort of getting so engaged in talking about the issues and how he could actually save millions of lives. And so I think I found these conversations with philanthropic capitalists incredibly inspiring, by and large, because they are very, very seriously engaged in how they can solve problems.
Often when we think about the big time givers, we think of people like Bono and Angelina Jolie and celebrities. Are they really the major big time givers, or do they just get all the publicity?
I think the fact is they do get a lot of the publicity, and that's what makes them really effective. I started out being very cynical about celebrity philanthropists. We call them philanthropists because I thought, it was all about their public image and so forth. But it turns out that if they manage their brand and their public reputation well, they can really have a huge impact. And Angelina Jolie said to me, if I phone up any politician or person on the planet, they will take my call. And there's very few people in the nonprofit world that can say that. They are actually working together now in a much more sophisticated way with philanthropists like Bill Gates, with governments, with organizations like the United Nations, with business, to actually use their fame in a good cause.
Matthew Bishop is New York Bureau Chief for The Economist and co-author of Philanthrocapitalism: How Giving Can Save the World. Matthew, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In Hong Kong's downtown financial district, it's not the well-to-do bankers who earn the most respect. It's the people who shine their shoes. These street vendors are widely admired for their buffing and brushing skills, as Violet Law saw when she met up with some of them. She sent us this story for our street vendor series. Lida Hartman does the narration.
Under the shadow of gleaming skyscrapers, a row of shoe shiners stands out in a sea of suits. They bow over the wingtips of well-heeled bankers and lawyers in a narrow alleyway called Theater Lane.
They're a bit of an attraction. They're part of the scene here, and I think it's quite a nice thing to have.
Mikhail, a lawyer who's shy about giving out his last name, stands with one foot propped up on a stool. He comes over every week to get his loafers polished by shoeshiners like Jung Hong. At 74, Jung started shining shoes only about 9 years ago, after a lifetime of back-breaking jobs. Still, he can't take it easy, he says, if he wants to do his job right.
There's a lot of pressure in polishing shoes. You know why? Because you have to get the front and the back. You can't cut corners. You have to make the shoes sparkle. If not, who needs you?
The shoe shiners earned their place in Hong Kong street culture during the Korean War, when American sailors on R&R made generous patrons. And as the city became westernized, many more Chinese shed their cloth shoes for leather, so shoe shining became a way to eke out a bit of a living. But late last year, the government demanded that all of them get a license, like other street vendors here. Shoeshiner Lau Kin was dismayed. Why should it matter whether we have a license or not, he says. We've been around for such a long time. Many patrons agreed. Bankers, lawyers, and even some legislators signed a petition asking the government to back off. In the end, though, the shoeshiners had no choice but to pay up, roughly $320 every year starting this year.
Okay.
Jung Hong has to shine 100 pairs in order to pay the license fee. Lately, though, the festivities of the Lunar New Year have brought him bigger tips. Now, if only the weather would cooperate.
People don't get their shoes done when it's raining. But now for the New Year, they all want to have a sparkling pair.
That story was produced by Violet Law. In the Rio de Janeiro slum where Samuel Muniz de Araujo was raised, he was known as Samuca the Thug. Now he's known as Samuca the Songwriter and Organizer. He directs a youth art community center in the same neighborhood where he was a soldier in the drug trade.
I was involved in crime since I was 16 years old. I ended up as the most wanted criminal in all of Rio de Janeiro. I was finally put in prison and served 7 years. I left jail with the intention of overcoming my past, to stay out of crime and to tell the story of my life so that children and adolescents can understand that there's another way out. To serve as an example, someone they can see and hear and think, wow, if he can do it, so can I.
Using hip-hop music and other art forms, Samuca gives local kids alternatives to crime. One of them is a teenager named Melk.
My name is Melk Jonathan Gifreitas Sidaji. I'm 18 years old. I entered the drug trade because I wanted what I didn't have and what I thought the drug traffic could give me. When Samuca talked to me, I told him that the only way I would leave the life of crime was dead. He was the only one who could help me. I used to approach drug traffickers with the same power that they had. Now I approach them with more power, because I show them that there's another world out there.
That's Melk's song called My Story, which he recorded with Samuca. Later this year, Samuca will release a book and a film about his own life called The Story That I Tell. Reporter Anil Mundra sent us that story from Brazil, and we have more stories to tell ahead on the World Vision Report. Stay with us.
Orientem mar revoltos navegantes e orientarás quem vive na escuridão.
This is the World Vision Report. I'm Beverly Abel, in for Peggy Waymire. Soldiers returning from war often struggle to cope with daily life. Many are haunted by what they witnessed and sometimes by what they participated in. We have a name for that now. We call it post-traumatic stress disorder. And servicemen returning from Iraq and Afghanistan have been treated for it. But in Lee Thorne's day, little attention was paid to returning soldiers. Back in 1966, Thorne's assignment was to load bombs onto planes that were bound for Laos, a small country west of Vietnam. Countless civilians died in the bombing. And for years, Lee Thorne was tormented by those deaths. Until he actually went to Laos. Mary Stuckey reports from the village of Champasak.
Champasak sits on a bank overlooking the Mekong River. Most people here are fishermen or subsistence rice farmers. There are a few shops, a temple, and a school, which sits at the edge of town. Dozens of bicycles are propped under a huge tree, surrounded by classrooms made of concrete and wood. If you ask students what they like best at their school, they'll take you to this room. It's lined with computers. Several kids are huddled around each computer. This day's assignment, do research on the internet. The subject, healthy eating. This 15-year-old says he's writing a report about how eating vegetables improves eyesight. These computers were donated by the Jai Foundation. Jai is a Lao word meaning harmony between people. The name is ironic since the foundation has its roots in war. During the Vietnam War, American Lee Thorne helped run bombing missions over Laos. After the war was over, he says he had no intention of ever going back.
Flashbacks. I have severe post-traumatic stress, and I was afraid that I'd get triggered.
But finally, in 1998, a friend convinced Thorne that it might actually do him good to visit Laos. He was amazed by what he found, a sincere welcome and forgiveness.
What I got from Lao people, or I'm sorry, what I was given by Lao people, was actually spiritual. First of all, I felt blessed to be there. And something shifted in me, and I wanted to keep learning from these guys.
Thorne decided to try to find a way to help the people of Laos, especially those in the countryside who were isolated and very poor.
You know, we'd say, what do you want, what do you want, what do you want? And they, one of the things they kept saying they wanted was communications, because at that time they had no cell phone, no landline, no electricity.
The villagers wanted to be able to get the weather report. They wanted to know what rice was selling for in the city so they could get the best price for their harvest. And they were desperate for contact with relatives living abroad. They wanted computers and the internet. So with money from friends, corporations, and charities, Thorne started the Jai Foundation. He discovered that he could power the computers using car batteries, bicycle-driven generators, or solar panels. He contacted a friend, a computer whiz in California, who developed a computer that could hold up to harsh conditions.
The original PC was very rugged. It was like you could dunk it in water. Not now, because very few people are going to use these outside. They didn't need to be that rugged in the cases that we're now dealing with. So now we're dealing with schools, and they have roofs.
Schools like the one in Champasak, which gets its internet connection via satellite. But before a village gets even one computer, Thorne insists that they draw up a business plan to support and maintain it. In Champasak, the school's computer room stays open for business after classes end for the day. Tourists who come through town pay to check email. Teacher Suntala Singh Sakta keeps a log.
In November, there are 6 tourists coming to use our internet. In December, there are 9 tourists come to use our internet.
But they make more money from villagers who pay to get on the computer and use Skype, the internet calling service, which is much cheaper than a regular phone call. Who are they calling? Friends and family, many who've emigrated to the United States. Vorason Denkayapich helps manage the computer project in Laos and says people who haven't seen each other in decades are delighted to talk and send photos over the internet.
At least the first they could not believe.
They couldn't believe it.
They could believe that. How could it be? How is the live, where's the connection go through the air? How it be?
How could a connection go through the air?
Yeah, that's what the people said. Some people, when they talk, they even cry when they talk on the phone, to each other.
Thorne has brought computers to 14 schools in Laos. Now he's working on a plan to provide isolated villagers with regular medical checkups. All the village needs is someone who's trained to hook the patient up to the computer, connecting patient and doctor via the internet.
The doctor can hear, like if you're doing a stethoscope, he can hear the beat. The doctor on the other side of the world or in the next village or whatever.
Whether it's connecting doctors and patients, family and friends, or farmers and their markets, the goal is to reduce the isolation of poor rural Laotians. But for Thorne, the connection was a personal one, born out of war, and reflected in that name he gave his foundation, Jai, harmony between people. For the World Vision Report, I'm Mary Stuckey in Champasak, Laos.
Lake Titicaca stretches between Peru and Bolivia. It's the largest lake in South America, and as you'd expect, it has quite a few islands. There are at least 50 of them just off the coast of Puno on the Peruvian side of the lake. But these are no ordinary islands. They're made of reeds, and they float on top of the water. They're home to more than 200 Uro people who've lived on these man-made islands for centuries. Reporter Kira Neal took a boat ride to the cluster of Reed Islands, and she brings us this reporter's notebook.
We're warmly greeted as our boat arrives at San Miguel Island, home to just four families. The islands are made completely of totora reeds, a hardy plant that grows along the edges of Lake Titicaca. When you step off the boat onto land, so to speak, your feet sink a bit, but the island is sturdy. It's securely anchored into the lake floor with sticks attached to long nylon ropes. The green reeds have been bleached to a golden yellow by the sun, so everything on the island is that color, since just about all of it is made from the reeds. The houses, boats, furniture, even huge fish and bird sculptures.
Tenemos un presidente para todos. Un presidente, un líder para todos.
Visitors learn about the history of this man-made island life from one of the local Uro guides. About 500 years ago, the Uro people hoped to escape conquest by the Incas, others say the Spanish, and so they fled the mainland to live on reed boats on Lake Titicaca. They subsisted on birds, fish, eggs, and the edible bottoms of the totora reeds themselves, which, I have to say, are pretty much tasteless. After some years, the Uros built semi-permanent islands, which varied in size but tended to average at 1 or 2 acres, and housed anywhere from 4 to 10 families. That's still the case today. Every 3 weeks, fresh totora reeds are spread over the islands to provide a new top layer. The islands last about 20 years, and at that point, a new one must be built from scratch.
El barco del Inca, Cocha Tata, Father Lake. Este es el Puma Titicaca, Pachamama, Mother Earth.
After our history lesson, tourists are let loose to walk around the one-acre island and to buy souvenirs from women sitting in a semicircle outside their homes. They've laid out colorful, intricate weavings on their blankets. Some are in patterns that show the history and life of the Uros. Others depict the Andean cosmology with gods of the sun, the water, and the lake. This commerce has brought the Uros into a cash economy, and that has allowed their young people to attend high school and even university in Puno. Some families are even beginning to pool their money to share the cost of a cell phone. As I climb back onto the boat with the other tourists, the families from San Miguel gather around and send us off with a song. As the boat heads back to the busy city of Puno, I'm left with a profound sense of wonder. Not only have the Uro been able to survive for centuries without much contact with the outside world, but they're now able to take advantage of the benefits it has to offer, without losing those connections to all that has, if you will, kept them afloat.
Kira Neal is a journalist based in New York City. Now we go to another island, the exotic Madagascar. Singer Razia Sayed was born there, and though she now lives in New York City, her music is full of the sounds of home. You can hear those sounds on her newly released second album, Zebu Nation. Razia Sayed spoke with the World Vision Report's Peggy Waymeyer. She said she did the research for the album by traveling around Madagascar and working with local musicians.
I thought it was so inspiring, and they were so good at what they were doing. And we don't have too much of Malagasy music outside of Madagascar. So I thought that it was a pity to have all this musical wealth and not being able to share it with the world.
When you visited your family and traveled around the country working with these local musicians, you got really upset about something. What happened on your visit there that troubled you?
The most important thing that happened during that specific trip was a lot of burning. There was a lot of slash and burning, which is this agriculture that we practice in Madagascar. So a lot of the smoke that was coming out from the forest and all along the road, it was very disturbing. I thought, we don't hear much about it, and someone should talk about this. So
why were they burning the forest?
To fertilize the soil this way, and they do fertilize it for about 3 seasons, and then after that it's just deprived of all nutrients. At the end, the soil is totally destroyed and useless.
How important are the forests to the country?
The forest is very important to the country, very important, I mean, not only to the country, it's important to the world, because Madagascar's forest, 1% of the world biodiversity is actually in Madagascar. But the forest is very important for Madagascar because of the ecotourism, which brings $380 million a year. The fact that they're burning the forest is basically depriving themselves of that income for the country and for themselves. The forests are source of water, and a lot of the animals that are endemic to Madagascar live in the forest. So this is back to the ecotourism. But I think that mostly for the water and for the fact that it's becoming desertified, you know, and the south of Madagascar is already pretty much desertic. So whatever, 10%, there's only 10% of the forest that is left in Madagascar.
Now, Razia, you grew up in Madagascar. Do you remember the forest as a little girl and what it meant to you?
Yeah, of course. I lived in that region of the northeast in this little town called Antala, which is surrounded. It's the vanilla town. It's a town where there's the most famous vanilla crop called the Bourbon vanilla. It's a town that is just surrounded by forest. And when I was a kid, of course, there was not as many people living in this town. So we had a lot of trees around, and I remember I was a total tomboy when I was a kid, so I was always in climbing on some trees and hiding in some trees. And so, yeah, it's a big part of my childhood. And going to, you know, up in the mountain, washing the clothes in the river, and, you know, surrounded by forest and the sounds of the forest, the smells of the forest.
Now, I know a number of the songs on your new album are dedicated to the whole theme of protecting Madagascar's forest.
Exactly, yes.
Which one should we listen to that would best illustrate your feelings about this?
Well, maybe we can listen to Mifuaza, yeah.
Now that's in Malagasy. What are the lyrics saying there? What's the song about?
Well, Mifuaza is wake up. So it's talking to the people of Madagascar and asking them to wake up to the danger of what is going on, that our forests are disappearing. Let's make an effort to pay attention, and telling them that, you know, we're not going to have anything left for future generations if we continue that way.
Now, I know that your grandmother raised you in Madagascar before you went to live with your mother in Gabon.
Yes.
And there's a song on your album that you actually dedicated to your grandma. I think it's called O Mama.
Yeah, that's it. O Mama. Deka faliana, deka lahelu, murafonya ngala nonazi. Ana mifuha, keka nyandru, mana selasieti sanya. Nova mangala ramura Goman fitiava noza Oh mama 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 hey. Oh mama 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 oh.
What are you saying to your grandmother in that song?
Oh, it's talking about her daily routine. You know, how in the morning she wakes up so early before the chicken are even up, you know, before the rooster call, she's already up washing the dishes, and how she raised so many children and did a great job doing that. And just thanking her and saying that she would be, you know, I would be always with her, even though I'm so far away.
Is your grandmother still alive?
Yeah, she's still alive. She's 85.
85, and I'm sure she's heard the album.
Of course.
What does she think of it?
The first time she heard it in Malagasy, she just had a few tears.
I bet.
And she said it's, you know, it's beautiful. She's very happy. She's happy with what I'm doing. She's very supportive.
Razia Saeed, thanks so much for sharing your music with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And we'll go out today on more music by Razia Saeed. While you're listening to that, you could check out our website, worldvisionreport.org. You can see some great photographs there, and you can read blogs from our reporters around the world. You can also post your comments. We're always interested in your feedback. Diane Toomey edits the show. Lida Hartman is the assignment editor. Cynthia Graber, Christina Darden, and Sue Shepherd are our producers. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Our engineering assistant is Emily Eagle. Our production assistant is Chris Baldiger. I'm Beverly Abel. Peggy Wehmeyer will be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Support for this program comes from World Vision, building a better world for children. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.